This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Insurgent by Veronica Roth. Performed by Emma Galvin. Like a wild animal, the truth is too powerful to remain caged. From the Candor Faction Manifesto. Chapter 1. I wake with his name in my mouth. Will. Before I open my eyes, I watch him crumple to the pavement again. Dead. My doing. Tobias crouches in front of me, his hand on my left shoulder. The train car bumps over the rails and Marcus, Peter, and Caleb stand by the doorway. I take a deep breath and hold it in an attempt to relieve some of the pressure that is building in my chest. An hour ago, nothing that happened felt real to me. Now it does. I breathe out, and the pressure is still there. Triss, come on, Tobias says. His eyes are searching mine. We have to jump. It is too dark to see where we are, but if we are getting off, we are probably close to the fence. Tobias helps me to my feet and guides me toward the doorway. The others jump off one by one. Peter first, then Marcus, then Caleb. I take Tobias's hand. The wind picks up as we stand at the edge of the car opening, like a hand pushing me back toward safety. But we launch ourselves into darkness and land hard on the ground. The impact hurts the bullet wound in my shoulder. I bite my lip to keep from crying out and search for my brother. Okay? I say when I see him sitting in the grass a few feet away, rubbing his knee. He nods. I hear him sniff like he's fending off tears, and I have to turn away. We landed in the grass near the fence, several yards away from the worn path that the Amity trucks travel to deliver food to the city, and the gate that lets them out, the gate that is currently shut, locking us in. The fence towers over us, too high and flexible to climb over, too sturdy to knock down.
There's supposed to be Dauntless guards here, says Marcus. Where are they?
They were probably under the simulation, Tobias says, and are now. He pauses. Who knows where? Doing who knows what? We stopped the simulation. The weight of the hard drive in my back pocket reminds me. But we didn't pause to see the aftermath. What happened to our friends, our peers, our leaders, our factions? There is no way to know. Tobias approaches a small metal box on the right side of the gate and opens it, revealing a keypad.
Let's hope the erudite didn't think to change this combination, he says as he types in a series of numbers.
He stops at the 8th one, and the gate clicks open.
How did you know that?
Says Caleb. His voice sounds thick with emotion. So thick I'm surprised it does not choke him on the way out.
I worked in the Dauntless control room, monitoring the security system. We only change the codes twice a year, Tobias says.
How lucky, says Caleb.
He gives Tobias a wary look.
Luck has nothing to do with it, Tobias says. I only worked there because I wanted to make sure I could get out.
I shiver. The way he talks about getting out, it's like he thinks we're trapped. I never thought about it that way before, and now that seems foolish. We walk in a small pack, Peter cradling his bloody arm to his chest, the arm that I shot, and Marcus with his hand on Peter's shoulder, keeping him stable. Caleb wipes his cheeks every few seconds, and I know he's crying, but I don't know how to comfort him, or why I am not crying myself. Instead, I take the lead, Tobias silent at my side, and though he does not touch me, he steadies me.
Pinpricks of light are the first sign that we are nearing Amity headquarters. Then squares of light that turn into glowing windows. A cluster of wooden and glass buildings. Before we can reach them,
We have to walk through an orchard. My feet sink into the ground, and above me, the branches grow into one another, forming a kind of tunnel. Dark fruit hangs among the leaves, ready to drop. The sharp, sweet smell of rotting apples mixes with the scent of wet earth in my nose. When we get close, Marcus leaves Peter's side and walks in front. "I know where to go," he says. He leads us past the first building to the second one on the left. All the buildings except the greenhouses are made of the same dark wood, unpainted, rough. I hear laughter through an open window. The contrast between the laughter and the stone stillness within me is jarring. Marcus opens one of the doors. I would be shocked by the lack of security if we were not at Amity headquarters. They often straddle the line between trust and stupidity. In this building, the only sound is of our squeaking shoes. I don't hear Caleb crying anymore. But then he was quiet about it before. Marcus stops before an open room, where Johanna Reyes, representative of Amity, sits, staring out the window. I recognize her because it is hard to forget Johanna's face, whether you've seen her once or 1,000 times. A scar stretches in a thick line from just above her right eyebrow to her lip, rendering her blind in one eye and giving her a lisp when she talks. I've only heard her speak once, but I remember. She would have been a beautiful woman if not for that scar. "Oh, thank God," she says when she sees Marcus. She walks toward him with her arms open. Instead of embracing him, she just touches his shoulders, like she remembers the abnegation's distaste for casual physical contact. "The other members of your party got here a few hours ago, but they weren't sure if you had made it," she says. She is referring to the group of abnegation who were with my father and Marcus in the safe house. I didn't even think to worry about them. She looks over Marcus's shoulder, first at Tobias and Caleb, then at me, then at Peter. "Oh my," she says, her eyes lingering on the blood-soaking Peter's shirt. "I'll send for a doctor. I can grant you all permission to stay the night, but tomorrow, our community must decide together. And," she eyes Tobias and me, "they will likely not be enthusiastic about a dauntless presence in our compound. I, of course, ask you to turn over any weapons you might have." I wonder suddenly how she knows that I am dauntless. I'm still wearing a gray shirt. My father's shirt. At that moment, his smell, which is an even mixture of soap and sweat, wafts upward, and it fills my nose, fills my entire head with him. I clench my hands so hard into fists that my fingernails cut into my skin. "Not here. Not here." Tobias hands over his gun, but when I reach behind me to take out my own concealed weapon, he grabs my hand, guiding it away from my back. Then he laces his fingers with mine to cover up what he just did. I know it's smart to keep one of our guns, but it would have been a relief to hand it over. "My name is Johanna Reyes," she says, extending her hand to me, and then Tobias. A dauntless greeting. I am impressed by her awareness of the customs of other factions. I always forget how considerate the Amity are until I see it for myself. "This is Marcus starts, but Tobias interrupts him. "My name is Four," he says. "This is Triss, Caleb, and Peter." A few days ago, Tobias was a name only I knew among the Dauntless. It was a piece of himself that he gave me. Outside Dauntless headquarters, I remember why he hid that name from the world. It binds him to Marcus. "Welcome to Amity Compound." Johanna's eyes fix on my face, and she smiles crookedly. "Let us take care of you." We do let them. An Amity nurse gives me a salve, developed by Erudite to speed healing, to put on my shoulder, and then escorts Peter to the hospital ward to mend his arm. Johanna takes us to the cafeteria, where we find some of the abnegation who were in the safe house with Caleb and my father. Susan is there, and some of our old neighbors, in rows of wooden tables as long as the room itself. They greet us, especially Marcus, with held-in tears and suppressed smiles. I cling to Tobias's arm. I sag under the weight of the members of my parents' faction, their lives, their tears. One of the abnegation puts a cup of steaming liquid under my nose and says, "Drink this. It will help you sleep as it helped some of the others sleep. No dreams." The liquid is pink-red, like strawberries. I grab the cup and drink it fast. For a few seconds, the heat from the liquid makes me feel like I am full of something again. And as I drain the last drops from the cup, I feel myself relaxing. Someone leads me down the hallway to a room with a bed in it. That is all. Chapter 2. I open my eyes, terrified, my hands clutching at the sheets. But I am not running through the streets of the city or the corridors of Dauntless Headquarters. I am in a bed in the Amity Headquarters, and the smell of sawdust is in the air. I shift and wince as something digs into my back. I reach behind me, and my fingers wrap around the gun. For a moment, I see Will standing before me, both our guns between us. His hand. I could have shot his hand. Why didn't I? Why? And I almost scream his name. Then, he's gone. I get out of bed and lift the mattress with one hand, propping it up on my knee. Then I shove the gun beneath it and let the mattress bury it. Once it is out of sight and no longer pressed to my skin, my head feels clearer. Now that the adrenaline rush of yesterday is gone, and whatever made me sleep has worn off, the deep ache and shooting pains of my shoulder are intense. I am wearing the same clothes I wore last night. The corner of the hard drive peeks out from under my pillow, where I shoved it right before I fell asleep. On it is the simulation data that controlled the Dauntless, and the record of what the erudite did. It feels too important for me to even touch, but I can't leave it here. So I grab it and wedge it between the dresser and the wall. Part of me thinks it would be a good idea to destroy it, but I know it contains the only record of my parents' death. So I'll settle for keeping it hidden. Someone knocks on my door. I sit on the edge of the bed and try to smooth my hair down. "Come in," I say. The door opens, and Tobias steps halfway in, the door dividing his body in half. He wears the same jeans as yesterday, but a dark red t-shirt instead of his black one, probably borrowed from one of the Amity. It's a strange color on him, too bright. But when he leans his head back against the door frame, I see that it makes the blue in his eyes lighter. "The Amity are meeting in a half hour." He quirks his eyebrows and adds, with a touch of melodrama, "to decide our fate." I shake my head. Never thought my fate would be in the hands of a bunch of Amity. Me either. "Oh, I brought you something." He unscrews the cap of a small bottle and holds out a dropper filled with clear liquid. "Pain medicine. Take a dropper full every 6 hours. "Thanks." I squeeze the dropper into the back of my throat. The medicine tastes like old lemon. He hooks a thumb in one of his belt loops and says, "How are you, Beatrice?"
"Did you just call me Beatrice?"
"Thought I would give it a try." He smiles. "Not good?"
"Maybe on special occasions only. Initiation days, choosing days."
I pause. I was about to rattle off a few more holidays, but only the abnegation celebrate them. The Dauntless have holidays of their own, I assume, but I don't know what they are. And anyway, the idea that we would celebrate anything right now is so ludicrous I don't continue. "It's a deal." His smile fades. "How are you, Triss?" It's not a strange question, after what we've been through. But I tense up when he asks it, worried that he'll somehow see into my mind. I haven't told him about Will yet. I want to, but I don't know how. Just the thought of saying the words out loud makes me feel so heavy I could break through the floorboards. I shake my head a few times. "I don't know, Four. I'm awake. I'm still shaking my head. He slides his hand over my cheek, one finger anchored behind my ear. Then he tilts his head down and kisses me, sending a warm ache through my body. I wrap my hands around his arm, holding him there as long as I can. When he touches me, the hollowed-out feeling in my chest and stomach is not as noticeable. I don't have to tell him. I can just try to forget. He can help me forget.
I know, he says. Sorry. I shouldn't have asked.
For a moment, all I can think is,
how could you possibly know? But something about his expression reminds me that he does know something about loss.
He lost his mother when he was young.
I don't remember how she died, just that we attended her funeral. Suddenly, I remember him clutching the curtains in his living room, about 9 years old, wearing gray, his dark eyes shut. The image is fleeting, and it could be my imagination, not a memory.
He releases me. I'll let you get ready. The women's bathroom is 2 doors down. The floor is dark brown tile, and each shower stall has wooden walls and a plastic curtain separating it from the central aisle. A sign on the back wall says, "Remember, to conserve resources, showers run for only 5 minutes." The stream of water is cold, so I wouldn't want the extra minutes even if I could have them. I wash quickly with my left hand, leaving my right hand hanging at my side. The pain medicine Tobias gave me worked fast. The pain in my shoulder has already faded to a dull throb. When I get out of the shower, a stack of clothes waits on my bed. It contains some yellow and red from the Amity, and some gray from the Abnegation, colors I rarely see side by side. If I had to guess, I would say that one of the Abnegation put the stack there for me. It's something they would think to do. I pull on a pair of dark red pants made of denim, so long I have to roll them up 3 times, and a gray Abnegation shirt that is too big for me. The sleeves come down to my fingertips, and I roll them up too. It hurts to move my right hand, so I keep the movement small and slow. Someone knocks on the door.
Beatrice?
The soft voice is Susan's. I open the door for her. She carries a tray of food, which she sets down on the bed. I search her face for a sign of what she has lost. Her father, an Abnegation leader, didn't survive the attack, but I see only the placid determination characteristic of my old faction.
I'm sorry the clothes don't fit, she says.
I'm sure we can find some better ones for you if the Amity allow us to stay.
They're fine, I say.
Thank you.
I heard you were shot. Do you need my help with your hair? Or your shoes?
I'm about to refuse, but I really do need help.
Yes. Thank you.
I sit down on a stool in front of the mirror, and she stands behind me, her eyes dutifully trained on the task at hand, rather than her reflection. They do not lift, not even for an instant, as she runs a comb through my hair. And she doesn't ask about my shoulder, how I was shot, what happened when I left the Abnegation safe house to stop the simulation. I get the sense that if I were here to whittle her down to her core, she would be Abnegation all the way through.
Have you seen Robert yet?
I say. Her brother Robert chose Amity when I chose Dauntless, so he is somewhere in this compound. I wonder if their reunion will be anything like Caleb's and mine.
Briefly, last night, she says. I left him to grieve with his faction as I grieve with mine. It is nice to see him again, though.
I hear a finality in her tone that tells me the subject is closed.
It's a shame this happened when it did, Susan says. Our leaders were about to do something wonderful.
Really? What?
I don't know, Susan blushes. I just knew that something was happening. I didn't mean to be curious, I just noticed things.
I wouldn't blame you for being curious even if you had been.
She nods and keeps combing.
I wonder what the Abnegation leaders, including my father, were doing. And I can't help but marvel at Susan's assumption that whatever they were doing was wonderful. I wish I could believe that of people again. If I ever did, The Dauntless wear their hair down, right? She says.
Sometimes, I say.
Do you know how to braid?
So her deft fingers tuck pieces of my hair into one braid that tickles the middle of my spine. I stare hard at my reflection until she finishes. I thank her when she's done, and she leaves with a small smile, closing the door behind her. I keep staring, but I don't see myself. I can still feel her fingers brushing the back of my neck, so much like my mother's fingers, the last morning I spent with her. My eyes wet with tears, I rock back and forth on the stool, trying to push the memory from my mind. I am afraid that if I start to sob, I will never stop until I shrivel up like a raisin. I see a sewing kit on the dresser. In it are two colors of thread, red and yellow, and a pair of scissors. I feel calm as I undo the braid in my hair and comb it again. I part my hair down the middle and make sure that it is straight and flat. I close the scissors over the hair by my chin. How can I look the same when she's gone and everything is different? I can't. I cut in as straight a line as I can, using my jaw as a guide. The tricky part is the back, which I can't see very well. So I do the best I can by touch instead of sight. Locks of blonde hair surround me on the floor in a semicircle. I leave the room without looking at my reflection again. When Tobias and Caleb come to get me later, they stare at me like I am not the person they knew yesterday.
You cut your hair, says Caleb, his eyebrows high. Grabbing hold of facts in the midst of shock is very erudite of him. His hair sticks up on one side from where he slept on it, and his eyes are bloodshot.
Yeah, I say. It's too hot for long hair.
Fair enough. We walk down the hallway together. The floorboards creak beneath our feet. I miss the way my footsteps echoed in the Dauntless compound. I miss the cool underground air. But mostly, I miss the fears of the past few weeks, rendered small by my fears now. We exit the building. The outside air presses around me like a pillow meant to suffocate me. It smells green, the way a leaf does when you tear it in half. Does everyone know you're Marcus's son? Caleb says. The abnegation, I mean?
Not to my knowledge, says Tobias, glancing at Caleb. And I would appreciate it if you didn't mention it.
I don't need to mention it. Anyone with eyes can see it for themselves.
Caleb frowns at him.
How old are you anyway?
18.
And you don't think you're too old to be with my little sister?
Tobias lets out a short laugh.
She isn't your little anything.
Stop it, both of you, I say.
A crowd of people in yellow walks ahead of us, toward a wide, squat building made entirely of glass. The sunlight reflecting off the panes feels like a pinch to my eyes. I shield my face with my hand to keep walking. The doors to the building are wide open. Around the edge of the circular greenhouse, plants and trees grow in troughs of water, or small pools. Dozens of fans positioned around the room serve only to blow the hot air around, so I'm already sweating. But that fades from my mind when the crowd before me thins, and I see the rest of the room. In its center grows a huge tree. Its branches are spread over most of the greenhouse, and its roots bubble up from the ground, forming a dense web of bark. In the spaces between the roots, I see not dirt but water, and metal rods holding the roots in place. I should not be surprised. The Amity spend their lives accomplishing feats of agriculture like this one, with the help of erudite technology. Standing on a cluster of roots is Johanna Reyes, her hair falling over the scarred half of her face. I learned in faction history that the Amity recognize no official leader. They vote on everything, and the result is usually close to unanimous. They are like many parts of a single mind, and Johanna is their mouthpiece. The Amity sit on the floor, most with their legs crossed, in knots and clusters that vaguely resemble the tree roots to me. The abnegation sit in tight rows a few yards to my left.
My eyes search the crowd for a few seconds before I realize what I'm looking for. My parents. I swallow hard and try to forget. Tobias touches the small of my back, guiding me to the edge of the meeting space, behind the abnegation. Before we sit down, he puts his mouth next to my ear and says,
"I like your hair that way."
I find a small smile to give him, and lean into him when I sit down, my arm against his. Johanna lifts her hands and bows her head. All conversation in the room ceases before I can draw my next breath. All around me, the Amity sit in silence, some with their eyes closed, some with their lips mouthing words I can't hear, some staring at a point far away. Every second chafes. By the time Johanna lifts her head, I am worn to the bone. "We have before us today an urgent question," she says, "which is, how will we conduct ourselves in this time of conflict, as people who pursue peace?" Every Amity in the room turns to the person next to him or her and starts talking. "How do they get anything done?" I say as the minutes of chatter wear on.
"They don't care about efficiency," Tobias says. "They care about agreement. Watch."
Two women in yellow dresses a few feet away rise and join a trio of men. A young man shifts so that his small circle becomes a large one with the group next to him. All around the room, the smaller crowds grow and expand, and fewer voices fill the room, until there are only three or four. I can only hear pieces of what they say. Peace, dauntless, erudite, safe house, involvement.
"This is bizarre," I say.
"I think it's beautiful," he says.
I give him a look.
"What?"
He laughs a little.
"They each have an equal role in government. They each feel equally responsible. And it makes them care. It makes them kind. I think that's beautiful."
"I think it's unsustainable," I say.
"Sure, it works for the Amity. But what happens when not everyone wants to strum banjos and grow crops? What happens when someone does something terrible and talking about it can't solve the problem?"
He shrugs.
"I guess we'll find out."
Eventually, someone from each of the big groups stands and approaches Johanna, picking their way carefully over the roots of the big tree. I expect them to address the rest of us, but instead they stand in a circle with Johanna and the other spokespeople and talk quietly. I begin to get the feeling that I will never know what they're saying. "They're not going to let us argue with them, are they?" I say.
"I doubt it," he says.
"We are done for."
When everyone has said his or her piece, they sit down again, leaving Johanna alone in the center of the room. She angles her body toward us and folds her hands in front of her.
Where will we go when they tell us to leave? Back into the city where nothing is safe?
Our faction has had a close relationship with Erudite for as long as any of us can remember. We need each other to survive, and we have always cooperated with each other, says Johanna. But we have also had a strong relationship with abnegation in the past, and we do not think it is right to revoke the hand of friendship when it has for so long been extended. Her voice is honey-sweet, and moves like honey too, slow and careful. I wipe the sweat from my hairline with the back of my hand. We feel that the only way to preserve our relationships with both factions is to remain impartial and uninvolved, she continues. Your presence here, though welcome, complicates that.
Here it comes, I think.
We have arrived at the conclusion that we will establish our faction headquarters as a safe house for members of all factions, she says, under a set of conditions. The first is that no weaponry of any kind is allowed on the compound. The second is that if any serious conflict arises, whether verbal or physical, all involved parties will be asked to leave. The third is that the conflict may not be discussed, even privately, within the confines of this compound. And the fourth is that everyone who stays here must contribute to the welfare of this environment by working.
We will report this to Erudite, Candor, and Dauntless as soon as we can. Her stare drifts to Tobias and me and stays there. You are welcome to stay here, if and only if you can abide by our rules, she says. That is our decision. I think of the gun I hid under my mattress, and the tension between me and Peter and Tobias and Marcus, and my mouth feels dry. I am not good at avoiding conflict.
We won't be able to stay long,
I say to Tobias under my breath. A moment ago he was still faintly smiling. Now the corners of his mouth have disappeared into a frown. No, we won't.
Chapter 3. That evening I return to my room and slide my hand beneath my mattress to make sure the gun is still there. My fingers brush over the trigger, and my throat tightens, like I am having an allergic reaction. I withdraw my hand and kneel on the edge of the bed, taking hard swallows of air until the feeling subsides. What is wrong with you? I shake my head, pull it together. And that is what it feels like, pulling the different parts of me up and in like a shoelace. I feel suffocated, but at least I feel strong. I see a flicker of movement in my periphery, and look out the window that faces the apple orchard. Johanna Reyes and Marcus Eaton walk side by side, pausing at the herb garden to pluck mint leaves from their stems. I am out of my room before I can even evaluate why I want to follow them. I sprint through the building so that I don't lose them. Once I am outside, I have to be more careful. I walk around the far side of the greenhouse, and after I see Johanna and Marcus disappear into one row of trees, I creep down the next row, hoping the branches will hide me if either of them looks back. Been confused about is the timing of the attack, says Johanna. Is it just that Janine finally finished planning it and acted, or was there an inciting incident of some kind? I see Marcus's face through a divided tree trunk. He presses his lips together and says, I suppose we'll never know. Johanna raises her good eyebrow. Will we? No, perhaps not. Johanna places her hand on his arm and turns toward him. I stiffen, afraid for a moment that she will see me. But she looks only at Marcus. I sink into a crouch and crawl toward one of the trees so that the trunk will hide me. The bark itches my spine, but I don't move. But you do know, she says. You know why she attacked when she did. I may not be Candor anymore, but I can still tell when someone is keeping the truth from me.
Inquisitiveness is self-serving, Johanna.
If I were Johanna, I would snap at him for a comment like that. But she says kindly, my faction depends on me to advise them. And if you know information this crucial, it is important that I know it also so that I can share it with them. I'm sure you can understand that, Marcus.
There's a reason you don't know all the things I know. A long time ago, the Abnegation were entrusted with some sensitive information, says Marcus. Janine attacked us to steal it, and if I am not careful, she will destroy it. So that is all I can tell you.
But surely,
no. Marcus cuts her off. This information is far more important than you can imagine. Most of the leaders in the city risked their lives to protect it from Janine, and died. And I will not jeopardize it now for the sake of sating your selfish curiosity.
Johanna is quiet for a few seconds. It's so dark now I can barely see my own hands. The air smells like dirt and apples, and I try not to breathe it too loudly.
I'm sorry, says Johanna. I must have done something to make you believe I am not trustworthy.
The last time I trusted a faction representative with this information, all my friends were murdered, he replies. I don't trust anyone anymore.
I can't help it. I lean forward so that I can see around the trunk of the tree. Both Marcus and Johanna are too preoccupied to notice the movement. They're close together, but not touching, and I've never seen Marcus look so tired, or Johanna so angry. But her face softens, and she touches Marcus's arm again.
this time with a light caress.
In order to have peace, we must first have trust, says Johanna.
So I hope you change your mind.
Remember that I have always been your friend, Marcus, even when you did not have many to speak of.
She leans in and kisses his cheek, then walks to the end of the orchard. Marcus stands for a few seconds, apparently stunned, and starts toward the compound.
The revelations of the past half hour buzz in my mind. I thought Janine attacked the abnegation to seize power, but she attacked them to steal information, information only they knew.
Then the buzzing stops as I remember something else Marcus said. Most of the leaders of this city risked their lives for it. Was one of those leaders my father? I have to know. I have to find out what could possibly be important enough for the abnegation to die for, and the erudite to kill for.
I pause before knocking on Tobias's door and listen to what's going on inside.
No, not like that,
Tobias says through laughter.
What do you mean, not like that?
I imitated you perfectly. The second voice belongs to Caleb.
You did not.
Well, do it again, then. I push open the door just as Tobias, who is sitting on the floor with one leg stretched out, hurls a butter knife at the opposite wall. It sticks handle out from a large hunk of cheese they positioned on top of the dresser. Caleb, standing beside him, stares in disbelief, first at the cheese, and then at me.
Tell me he's some kind of Dauntless prodigy, says Caleb.
Can you do this too? He looks better than he did earlier. His eyes aren't red anymore, and some of the old spark of curiosity is in them, like he is interested in the world again. His brown hair is tousled, his shirt buttons in the wrong buttonholes. He's handsome in a careless way, my brother, like he has no idea what he looks like most of the time.
With my right hand, maybe, I say.
But yes, Four is some kind of Dauntless prodigy. Can I ask why you're throwing knives at cheese? Tobias's eyes catch mine on the word Four. Caleb doesn't know that Tobias wears his excellence all the time, in his own nickname.
Caleb came by to discuss something, Tobias says, leaning his head against the wall as he looks at me. And knife throwing just came up somehow.
As it so often does, I say, a small smile inching its way across my face. He looks so relaxed, his head back, his arms slung over his knee. We stare at each other for a few more seconds than is socially acceptable.
Caleb clears his throat.
Anyway, I should be getting back to my room, Caleb says, looking from Tobias to me and back again. I'm reading this book about the water filtration systems. The kid who gave it to me looked at me like I was crazy for wanting to read it. I think it's supposed to be a repair manual, but it's fascinating. He pauses.
Sorry. You probably think I'm crazy, too.
Not at all, Tobias says with mock sincerity.
Maybe you should read that repair manual, too, Triss.
Sounds like something you might like.
I can loan it to you, Caleb says.
Maybe later, I say. When Caleb closes the door behind him, I give Tobias a dirty look.
Thanks for that, I say.
Now he's going to talk my ear off about water filtration and how it works.
Though I guess I might prefer that to what he wants to talk to me about.
Oh?
And what's that?
Tobias quirks his eyebrows.
Aquaponics.
Aqua what?
It's one of the ways they grow food here. You don't want to know.
You're right, I don't, I say. What did he come to talk to you about?
You,
he says.
I think it was the big brother talk. Don't mess around with my sister and all that.
He gets up.
What did you tell him?
He comes toward me. I told him how we got together.
That's how knife throwing came up, he says. And I told him I wasn't messing around.
I feel warm everywhere. He wraps his hands around my hips and presses me gently against the door. His lips find mine. I don't remember why I came here in the first place. And I don't care. I wrap my uninjured arm around him, pulling him against me. My fingers find the hem of his t-shirt and slide beneath it, spreading wide over the small of his back. He feels so strong. He kisses me again, more insistent this time, his hands squeezing my waist, his breaths, my breaths, his body, my body. We are so close, there's no difference. He pulls back, just a few centimeters. I almost don't let him get that far.
This isn't what you came here for, he says.
No.
What did you come for, then?
Who cares? I push my fingers through his hair and draw his mouth to mine again. He doesn't resist, but after a few seconds he mumbles,
Triss,
against my cheek.
Okay, okay.
I close my eyes. I did come here for something important, to tell him the conversation I overheard. We sit side by side on Tobias's bed, and I start from the beginning. I tell him how I followed Marcus and Johanna into the orchard. I tell him Johanna's question about the timing of the simulation attack and Marcus's response and the argument that followed. As I do, I watch his expression. He does not look shocked or curious. Instead, his mouth works its way into the bitter pucker that accompanies any mention of Marcus.
Well, what do you think?
I say once I finish.
I think,
he says carefully, that it's Marcus trying to feel more important than he is. That was not the response I was expecting.
So? What?
You think he's just talking nonsense?
I think there probably is some information the abnegation knew that Janine wanted to know, but I think he's exaggerating its importance, trying to build up his own ego by making Johanna think he's got something she wants and he won't give it to her.
I frown. I don't think you're right. He didn't sound like he was lying.
You don't know him like I do. He is an excellent liar.
He is right. I don't know Marcus, and certainly not as well as he does. But my instinct was to believe Marcus, and I usually trust my instincts.
Maybe you're right, I say.
But shouldn't we find out what's going on, just to be sure?
I think it's more important that we deal with the situation at hand, says Tobias. Go back to the city, find out what's going on there. Find a way to take Erudite down. Then maybe we can find out what Marcus was talking about after this is all resolved, okay?
I nod. It sounds like a good plan. A smart plan. But I don't believe him. I don't believe it's more important to move forward than to find out the truth. When I found out that I was divergent, when I found out that Erudite would attack abnegation, those revelations changed everything. The truth has a way of changing a person's plans.
But it is difficult to persuade Tobias to do something he doesn't want to do, and even more difficult to justify my feelings with no evidence except my intuition.
So I agree, but I do not change my mind. Chapter 4.
Biotechnology has been around for a long time, but it wasn't always very effective, Caleb says. He starts on the crust of his toast. He ate the middle first, just like he used to when we were little. He sits across from me in the cafeteria, at the table closest to the windows. Carved into the wood along the table's edge are the letters D and T, linked together by a heart. So small, I almost didn't see them. I run my fingers over the carving as Caleb speaks. But Erudite scientists developed this highly effective mineral solution a while back. It was better for the plants than dirt, he says. It's an earlier version of that salve they put on your shoulder. It accelerates the growth of new cells. His eyes are wild with new information. Not all the Erudite are power-hungry and devoid of conscience, like their leader Janine Matthews. Some of them are like Caleb, fascinated by everything, dissatisfied until they find out how it works. I rest my chin on my hand and smile a little at him. He seems upbeat this morning. I am glad he has found something to distract him from his grief.
So Erudite and Amity work together then? I say.
More closely than Erudite and any other faction, he says.
Don't you remember from our faction history book?
It called them the essential factions. Without them, we would be incapable of survival.
Some of the erudite texts called them the enriching factions. And one of the erudite's missions as a faction was to become both essential and enriching. It doesn't sit well with me. How much our society needs erudite to function. But they are essential. Without them, there would be inefficient farming, insufficient medical treatments, and no technological advance. I bite my apple. "You aren't going to eat your toast?" he says.
"The bread tastes strange," I say.
"You can have it if you want."
I'm amazed by how they live here,
he says as he takes the toast from my plate.
They're completely self-sustaining. They have their own source of power, their own water pumps, their own water filtration, their own food sources. They're independent.
Independent, I say, and uninvolved. Must be nice.
It is nice, from what I can tell.
The large windows beside our table let in so much sunlight, I feel like I'm sitting outside. Clusters of Amity sit at the other tables, their clothes bright against their tan skin. On me, the yellow looks dull.
"So I take it Amity wasn't one of the factions you had an aptitude for," he says, grinning.
"No." The group of Amity a few seats away from us bursts into laughter. They haven't even glanced in our direction since we sat down to eat.
"Keep it down, all right? It's not something I want to broadcast."
"Sorry," he says, leaning over the table so that he can talk quieter.
"So what were they?" I feel myself tensing, straightening.
"Why do you want to know?"
"Triss," he says, "I'm your brother. You can tell me anything."
His green eyes never waver. He's abandoned the useless spectacles he wore as a member of Erudite in favor of an abnegation gray shirt and their trademark short haircut. He looks just as he did a few months ago, when we were living across the hall from each other, both of us considering switching factions but not brave enough to tell one another. Not trusting him enough to tell him was a mistake I did not want to make again.
"Abnegation, Dauntless," I say, "and Erudite."
"Three factions?" His eyebrows lift.
"Yes. Why?"
"It just seems like a lot," he says. "We each had to choose a research focus in erudite initiation, and mine was the aptitude test simulation, so I know a lot about the way it's designed. It's really difficult for a person to get two results. The program actually doesn't allow it. But to get three? I'm not even sure how that's possible."
"Well, the test administrator had to alter the test," I say. "She forced it to go to that situation on the bus so that she could rule out erudite. Except erudite wasn't ruled out."
Caleb props his chin on a fist.
"A program override," he says. "I wonder how your test administrator knew how to do that. It's not something they're taught."
I frown. Tori was a tattoo artist and an aptitude test volunteer. How did she know how to alter the aptitude test program? If she was good with computers, it was only as a hobby, and I doubt that a computer hobby would enable someone to fiddle with an erudite simulation.
Then something from one of my conversations with her surfaces. "My brother and I both transferred from erudite."
"She was erudite," I say. "A faction transfer. Maybe that's how?"
"Maybe," he says, tapping his fingers from left to right against his cheek.
Our breakfasts sit, almost forgotten between us.
"What does this mean about your brain chemistry?
Or anatomy?" I laugh a little.
"I don't know. All I know is that I'm always aware during simulations, and sometimes I can wake myself up from them. Sometimes they don't even work. Like the attack simulation."
"How do you wake yourself up from them? What do you do?"
I try to remember. I feel like it has been a long time since I was in one, though it was only a few weeks.
It's hard to say, because the Dauntless simulations were supposed to end when we had calmed down. But in one of mine, the one where Tobias figured out what I was, I just did something impossible. I broke glass just by putting my hand on it.
Caleb's expression becomes distant, like he is looking into faraway places. Nothing like what I just described ever happened to him in the aptitude test simulation.
I know.
So maybe he is wondering what it felt like, or how it's possible. My cheeks grow warmer. He is analyzing my brain like he would analyze a computer or a machine.
Hey, I say.
Come back.
Sorry, he says, focusing on me again. It's just...
fascinating? Yeah, I know.
You always look like someone sucked the life right out of you when something fascinates you.
He laughs.
Can we talk about something else, though? I say.
There may not be any erudite or dauntless traders around, but it still feels weird talking about it in public like this.
All right.
Before he can go on, the cafeteria doors open, and a group of abnegation come in. They wear Amity clothes, like me. But also like me, it's obvious what faction they are really in. They are silent, but not somber. They smile at the Amity they pass, inclining their heads, a few of them stopping to exchange pleasantries. Susan sits down next to Caleb with a small smile. Her hair is pulling back in its usual knot, but her blonde hair shines like gold. She and Caleb sit just slightly closer than friends would. Though they do not touch, she bobs her head to greet me.
I'm sorry, she says. Did I interrupt?
No, says Caleb.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm just about to flee the dining hall rather than participate in careful, polite abnegation conversation when Tobias comes in, looking harassed. He must have been working in the kitchen this morning, as part of our agreement with the Amity. I have to work in the laundry rooms tomorrow.
What happened?
I say as he sits down next to me.
In their enthusiasm for conflict resolution, the Amity have apparently forgotten that meddling creates more conflict, says Tobias.
If we stay here much longer, I'm going to punch someone, and it's not going to be pretty. Caleb and Susan both raise their eyebrows at him. A few of the Amity at the table next to ours stop talking to stare.
You heard me, Tobias says to them. They all look away.
As I said, I say, covering my mouth to hide my smile, what happened?
I'll tell you later.
It must have to do with Marcus. Tobias doesn't like the dubious looks the abnegation give him when he refers to Marcus's cruelty, and Susan is sitting right across from him. I clasp my hands in my lap.
The abnegation sit at our table, but not right next to us, a respectful distance of 2 seats away, though most of them still nod at us.
They were my family's friends and neighbors and co-workers, and before their presence would have encouraged me to be quiet and self-effacing. Now it makes me want to talk louder, to be as far from that old identity and the pain that accompanies it as possible.
Tobias goes completely still when a hand falls on my right shoulder, sending prickles of pain down my right arm. I clench my teeth to keep from groaning.
She got shot in that shoulder, Tobias says without looking at the man behind me. My apologies.
Marcus lifts his hand and sits down on my left.
Hello.
What do you want?
I say.
Beatrice, Susan says quietly. There's no need to...
Susan, please, says Caleb quietly.
She presses her lips into a line and looks away.
I frown at Marcus. I asked you a question.
I would like to discuss something with you, says Marcus.
His expression is calm, but he's angry. The terseness in his voice betrays him.
The other abnegation and myself have discussed it, and decided that we should not stay here. We believe that given the inevitability of further conflict in our city, it would be selfish of us to stay here while what remains of our faction is inside that fence. We would like to request that you escort us.
I did not expect that. Why does Marcus want to return to the city? Is it really just an abnegation decision? Or does he intend to do something there? Something that has to do with whatever information the abnegation have?
I stare at him for a few seconds, and then look at Tobias.
He is relaxed a little, but he keeps his eyes focused on the table.
I don't know why he acts this way around his father. No one, not even Janine, makes Tobias cower.
What do you think? I say.
I think we should leave the day after tomorrow.
Tobias says.
Okay. Thank you,
says Marcus. He gets up and sits at the other end of the table with the rest of the abnegation. I inch closer to Tobias, not sure how to comfort him without making things worse. I pick up my apple with my left hand and grab his hand under the table with my right. But I can't keep my eyes away from Marcus. I want to know more about what he said to Johanna. And sometimes, if you want the truth, you have to demand it.
Chapter 5. After breakfast, I tell Tobias I'm going for a walk, but instead, I follow Marcus. I expect him to walk to the guests' dormitory, but he crosses the field behind the dining hall and walks into the water filtration building. I hesitate on the bottom step. Do I really want to do this? I walk up the steps and through the door that Marcus just closed behind him. The filtration building is small, just one room with a few huge machines in it. As far as I can tell, some of the machines take in dirty water from the rest of the compound. A few of them purify it, others test it, and the last set pumps clean water back out to the compound. The piping systems are all buried except one, which runs along the ground to send water to the power plant near the fence. The plant provides power to the entire city, using a combination of wind, water, and solar energy. Marcus stands near the machines that filter the water. There, the pipes are transparent. I can see brown-tinged water rushing through one pipe, disappearing into the machine, and emerging clear. Both of us watch the purification happen, and I wonder if he is thinking what I am. That it would be nice if life worked this way, stripping the dirt from our lives and sending us out into the world clean. But some dirt is destined to linger. I stare at the back of Marcus's head. I have to do this now. Now. I heard you the other day, I blurt out. Marcus whips his head around. What are you doing, Beatrice? I followed you here. I fold my arms over my chest. I heard you talking to Johanna about what motivated Janine's attack on abnegation. Did the Dauntless teach you that it's all right to invade another person's privacy, or did you teach yourself? I'm a naturally curious person. Don't change the subject. Marcus's forehead is creased, especially between the eyebrows, and there are deep lines next to his mouth. He looks like a man who has spent most of his life frowning. He might have been handsome when he was younger. Perhaps he still is to women his age, like Johanna. But all I see when I look at him are the black pit eyes from Tobias's fear landscape. If you heard me talking to Johanna, then you know that I didn't even tell her about this. So what makes you think that I would share the information with you? I don't have an answer at first, but then it comes to me. My father, I say. My father is dead. It's the first time I've said it since I told Tobias, on the train ride over, that my parents died for me. Died was just a fact to me then, detached from emotion. But dead, mingling with the churning and bubbling noises in this room, strikes a blow like a hammer to my chest, and the monster of grief awakens, clawing at my eyes and throat. I force myself to continue. He may not have actually died for whatever information you were referring to, I say, but I want to know if it was something he risked his life for. Marcus's mouth twitches. Yes, he says. It was. My eyes fill with tears. I blink them away. Well, I say, almost choking. Then what on earth was it? Was it something you were trying to protect or steal or what? It was... Marcus shakes his head. I'm not going to tell you that. I step toward him. But you want it back. And Janine has it. Marcus is a good liar. Or at least someone who is skilled at hiding secrets. He does not react. I wish I could see like Johanna sees, like the Candor see. I wish I could read his expression. He could be close to telling me the truth. If I press just hard enough, maybe he'll crack. I could help you, I say. Marcus's upper lip curls. You have no idea how ridiculous that sounds. He spits the words at me,
You may have succeeded in shutting down the attack simulation, girl.